Welcome to Truth vs. Hollywood. I'm David Chen.
And I'm Joanna Robinson.
Truth vs. Hollywood is a look at films that are based on a true story. But we don't just talk about the film, we also talk about that true story. On this podcast, we touch on what really happened, how that differs from the film, and why. We'll also hear about the true story through interviews from experts, witnesses, and the people who were involved.
This is part two of our discussion of the David Fincher film Zodiac. So if you haven't already, you should go back and listen to part one. But when we last left off, the two lead detectives on the case, Dave Toski, played by Mark Ruffalo, and Bill Armstrong, played by Anthony Edwards, finally had a real lead on a suspect named Arthur Lee Allen, played by John Carroll Lynch. Is this man the Zodiac, or will they just be sidetracked for another 2 hours or more? Armstrong and Toski are sitting in a diner talking about how they need more handwriting samples. And they also find out that Lee is ambidextrous, which is intriguing. Toski and Armstrong, along with Vallejo Detective Mullinex, played by Elias Koteas, head over to Lee's place of work and speak with him in a meeting room. The interview is very civil. Lee says he's been interviewed before about the Zodiac case. But before they even ask any questions, he over-explains why he has bloody knives in his cars. Way to be suspicious, my friend.
I mean, I've definitely opened conversations by explaining the bloody knives in my car. So I was very sympathetic to Lee here.
I mean, that's how we start every phone call, right, Dave?
Pretty much.
I think that's, yeah.
Pretty much. I mean, we should say, like, this scene is almost comically, like, this is the guy. You know what I mean?
Right.
In a way that I think is intended to be almost funny.
Like, so. Funny in that he's already been interviewed. Do you know? Like,
yeah.
A lot of the tension of the scene is, like, this guy, someone already talked to this guy? Really?
Right.
Things get even more suspicious, right? He wears a Zodiac watch. He says the most dangerous game is his favorite book, but he denies being ambidextrous. And then he ends the interview with, I'm not the Zodiac, and if I was, I wouldn't tell you. Another thing we should mention, we mentioned this in the in part one, but this interview, more than anything else, reminds me of Fincher's Netflix series Mindhunter, right? Which sees law enforcement interview a number of serial killers to try to get there. And those interviews are like the meat of Mindhunter. Every single scene where they interview another great character actor playing another serial killer is completely engrossing theater. And I feel like this is the origin story of that series, is this scene with John Carroll Lynch, who's a great character actor, who played a lot of cuddly roles before this one, but then started getting cast as murderers after this performance.
Indeed. And I think it's best captured later on in the movie when Toski, played by Mark Ruffalo, says, like, I wish I could have taken him in right there. You know what I mean? You just feel like, man, these guys really feel like they have their man with Arthur Lee Allen. But we'll learn more about whether or not they do later on in the movie. So the detectives talk with Lee's brother and sister-in-law and learn more damning information. He was fired from a school for molesting kids, and that Cheney, who first presented them with this lead, is in fact a trustworthy person. They give some letters to Lee's brother to look at to see if it's his handwriting, and there are some similarities in the spelling mistakes. So the detectives talked to the Vallejo police, who interviewed Lee back during the Barriessa murder, but they said he didn't look like he fit the description, so they didn't pursue him. Here's Zodiac case expert Michael Butterfield to corroborate.
Five days later, during the murder of cab driver Paul Stein, several witnesses described the killer as 5'8 or 5'9, 180 pounds, with a short, crew-cut, reddish, blonde, or brown hair. That description did not match Arthur Lee Allen by any stretch of the imagination.
And in the end, the handwriting expert says the handwriting doesn't match, so they don't have enough information to get a warrant.
So that's the end of the Allen trail for now. But this film really wants you to believe it's Allen because, as we'll see later, Robert Graysmith, whose book this film is based on, thought he was the most viable suspect. But even from the evidence they show in the film that the handwriting doesn't match, he doesn't match the description of the man in the cab, we don't have conclusive ironclad evidence that Arthur Lee Allen was a Zodiac murderer. And Dave and I will sort of discuss our take on the viability of the suspect and the stance that the film takes at the end of this podcast.
So we get a montage of the Transamerica Pyramid being built to show the passage of time.
As a Bay Area resident, that is a crazy, crazy montage. Like, I don't know. Like, you live and the passage of time happens and like, and you know, other buildings that weren't there when you were born. But the Transamerica building has always been there for me in my lifetime. Mm. And so to watch this this footage of it being built is, I was like, what do you mean? It's always been there. I should just say really quickly that that footage, I was curious when I was watching it. I was like, is this archival footage? Whatever. The time-lapse building of the Transamerica building, as maybe anyone with two eyeballs in their head can see, is CGI completely. But for me, I mean, it was convincing enough that I had a question about it. I was like, is this real footage? And so anyway, Fincher created that, we should say.
It's a beautiful sequence and effectively shows that, hey, a lot of time has passed. Win-win there. But at the Chronicle, Avery, who's played by Robert Downey Jr., is pretty strung out and an alcoholic, writing crazy letters and asking to be put as the head of the Zodiac investigation. He goes off in the middle of the day to get a drink, and Graysmith, who's played by Jake Gyllenhaal, checks in on him. Now, in no way did the Zodiac case make Paul Avery go on an alcoholic bender and continued spiral that got him fired from the Chronicle, as the film depicts. In fact, he was the head reporter on the kidnapping of Patty Hearst. Here's Duffy Jennings, a fellow Chronicle reporter, to talk about that.
Paul Avery started to focus his attention on the Symbionese Liberation Army and covering the Hearst kidnap, and over the next couple of months, there's a lot of detail. That's a big national story. All of us were involved in some way or another. I covered the food giveaway that they ordered Hearst to do out in the poor neighborhoods. I would have to stand duty outside the Hearst mansion down in Hillsborough for any potential developments, press conferences.
And Avery wrote a book on his reports called The Voices of Guns. So I do think it's interesting to reflect on like why the movie decided to make this change. And I think what it's trying to do is that it's just trying to show that like there's this kind of blast radius of something like the Zodiac Killer. Not only is it destroying the lives of the people who have been touched by these murders, but like even the people trying to catch him have their lives in some way ruined as well, right? Graysmith spirals out of control with his Zodiac obsession, loses his family. Avery becomes a terrible alcoholic. Toski gets demoted from the force after being accused of forgery. Two out of those three things actually did happen in real life. So, you know, I guess they thought it was important to give Avery this kind of nosediving arc where everything falls into disrepair for him. But yeah, it is interesting to reflect on the fact that the movie decided to make this change.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm pretty impressed by the contrast between when this character shows up and where we see him at the end, living in a very identifiable houseboat in Sausalito, California, by the way. It is an interesting liberty to take when so much of this film is anchored in real-life events. So,
right, yeah.
So Bill Armstrong checks in again on the Allen family because Arthur's sister-in-law was concerned that they had stopped investigating him. So they pick it back up, and the detectives go to another handwriting expert and another until they get an opinion they want, basically. They have the witness Don Chaney agree to testify to what Lee told him and sign his affidavit, and finally they get a warrant to search Lee's trailer. So we go inside Arthur Lee Allen's trailer. It looks exactly like my home in that there are a lot of squirrels, weird magazine lying around, dead squirrels in the freezer. I mean, I don't know what you're doing with your life if you don't have dead squirrels in the freezer. Apparently he had dead squirrels in the freezer because it was part of his research for his biology degree, which I don't think is clear in the film at all.
I'll just say, by the way, that it's actually like really upsetting to see a squirrel indoors. I didn't realize that until I saw this movie. Because it's just like, it just feels like it's not supposed to be there. You know what I mean?
I just want to say that I was an English major in college. All you found in my, to indicate my degree, was like too many books. But I lived with one pre-med and two entomology majors. Our freezer was a horror show. There were a lot of bugs in our freezer in college, so I buy this dead squirrels thing. But the cops also find some clothes that match one of the descriptions of the Zodiac, although it's a generic blue windbreaker. So, you know, nothing too specific there. And after coming up with not quite enough, the chief of police says they have to move on to other suspects. And Toski is upset, but has to comply. We get a fictionalized scene where Toski and Graysmith encounter each other at a film premiere of Dirty Harry. That didn't actually happen. But what is true is that the film Dirty Harry was changed from its original concept to be set in San Francisco and base some details on the Zodiac Killer to sort of cynically capitalize on the nation's obsession with the Zodiac Killer. We see the Toski character react very poorly to this decision, but, you know, we don't know exactly what Dave Toski thought of the film.
So while the scene between Toski and Graysmith didn't really happen, there was a very interesting story about a different film premiere. Before the Fincher film in 1971, there was a film called The Zodiac Killer, and because it was still at the height of the investigation, they decided to try to use it to lure out the killer himself. Former Chronicle reporter Duffy Jennings tells the story.
He would say things about, I'm waiting for a movie to come out about me. You know, there was one instance where there was a movie, an early movie about Zodiac, before the definitive one by David Fincher, that the police made an effort to catch him by putting a box in the lobby of the theater and asking people to enter a contest by saying, by writing down, I forget what the question was.
The question was, I believe the Zodiac kills because.
And that somebody actually was sitting inside the box waiting for us one of those entry slips to come through with handwriting that looked like Zodiac's, which never happened. And the movie wasn't very good and didn't do much at the box office.
So that plan didn't work, but it was a valiant effort because, after all, we see from this movie the killer clearly wanted media attention. So it made sense that he would go see the film made about him. But either he didn't show up or he didn't answer the question.
So back in the action of the film, we got a 4-year time lapse. According to Fincher, the blackout card was originally going to be a music montage of the hits over those 4 years, but that was cut for time. So instead, we get this scene at the Chronicle where a new crime reporter moves into Avery's space. And hey, it's Duffy Jennings, who we've been hearing from. In the film, he's played by the great Adam Goldberg. Jennings says he's actually started at the Chronicle a few days before the Paul Stein murder, but just wasn't on the Zodiac beat. But in the film, he's straight up Paul Avery's replacement, and he's not interested in being Grace's friend. This shift signals the end of Graysmith being just an onlooker. He's on his own, so now he has to go bold. Meanwhile, we get a bittersweet scene where Toski drops Armstrong off for the last time. Armstrong announces he's decided to transfer out of homicide. And this is another one. You talk about the blast radius, Dave. This is another. The implication is like Armstrong just can't handle being in homicide in general, but maybe also just the lingering question and pressure of the unsolved Zodiac case hanging over him. I think Anthony Edwards is great in this role, and I think the scene where, you know, I don't think a longtime partner would announce as he's leaving the car, hey, I'm not coming back to work tomorrow, so that's some dramatic license,
right.
But it really works. You feel the pain and the understanding that Toski feels here. And then later, Toski is so protective of Armstrong, not drawing him back into the case, and I really like that aspect too.
Yeah, well put. So at home, Graysmith is going through his scrapbook of Zodiac Killer clips. He's now married to the woman he went on one date with, and they have a kid together. She says he has the most Zodiac stuff, and this gives him an idea to write a book. So she's very supportive of this weird hobby, but eventually she's going to regret it. Graysmith goes to find Paul Avery, who now lives in a boathouse, looks terrible. Avery pours Graysmith a drink, and himself drinks straight from the bottle. Graysmith says someone should write a book about the Zodiac and they should collaborate on it because Paul knows the case and has all the files. Paul is dismissive and uninterested, so Graysmith leaves. Again, none of the scenes they have together really happened. Avery was still at the Chronicle.
It's fascinating because, honestly, if you live in the Bay Area, this is a very famous houseboat, and I almost want to say that they like just wanted to film at the Sausalito houseboats.
This houseboat specifically is very famous, you're saying?
The whole stretch, like, there's a whole little community of houseboats in Sausalito, but this is the most from my, in my opinion, the most iconic looking of them, with the brown shingle. And what's funny is those houseboats are actually extremely expensive to live in. So it's meant to show his like downward spiral and decay. It's actually a very like coveted spot in the Bay Area.
Right.
So
same thing in Seattle, by the way, which is where I live. Like there is a little houseboat community. The city of Seattle no longer issues houseboat permits.
Right.
So like the remaining ones that are there
exactly.
like are very highly valued. So it's interesting that like it's supposed to indicate he's in rock bottom because he's living in a houseboat, whereas today living in a houseboat would be a sign of how well you're doing.
Exactly right.
Right. Yeah. So
Gray Smith comes home from the library again. Love that he's a library guy. and now is the start of his truly deep obsession. Gray Smith offers to buy Toski lunch and tries to ply him for information. Toski absolutely refuses for a while, but after seeing some of the research, he offers advice in the form of, "I can't help you, but you should see this person in this town." This is the beginning of the section of the story that I really like, which is Ruffalo's character helping but not helping with a book. I don't know why, just every time they return to Toski, I got really into it. So this is the, I don't know, maybe it's like the momentum of like we're sort of rounding the corner towards the end of the film and I'm like, what's going to happen? But I like this section a lot.
I think you're right. Like the movie feels like two separate movies almost. There's like the first half, which has kind of Mark Ruffalo and Anthony Edwards and Paul Avery pursuing the case. And then there's like this big break. And then it's Jake Gyllenhaal's show for the rest of the movie. And it does feel like, hey, this character is carrying on the work that these other characters either can't or won't do or aren't inclined to do, you know, because of all the things they've already been through to try to solve this case. And I love the relationship between Mark Ruffalo and Jake Gyllenhaal's characters because it very much feels like, hey, this is the stuff I can't do, but I understand your mission. I respect your mission. I admire your mission, Gray Smith, and therefore I'm going to help you perhaps under the table, perhaps on the side, perhaps in a way that people won't be able to track or know about. And I appreciate that. I think like it symbolizes that like sometimes, you know, quests can continue long after like the primary person who drove that quest is involved with it.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So speaking of the Gray Smith Toski relationship, there's one scene where they're meeting together and he asks about the first survivor, Mike Majot. The other victim in that attack was Darlene Farren, and he was able to get some info from Vallejo that she was being followed. She had a lot of stalkers and admirers. This much is true. One of the main suspects in the case was pursued because of testimony from a few of Darlene's friends. Here's Zodiac case expert Michael Butterfield, who has some more details.
Years later, a girl who had once babysat for Darlene Farren told police that at one time she had seen a man sitting in a car parked outside of Darlene's house and that he appeared to be watching her. Darlene said something to the effect of this man was bothering her or stalking her, and the babysitter told this to police and they investigated that possibility. Investigators were naturally intrigued by the babysitter's story because if it was true, it could indicate a motive for Darlene Farren's murder. If she had seen another person killed, that would give the killer a reason to silence her. This also contributed to the idea that Darlene knew the killer, that she had been stalked months before her death, and this contributed to the overall myth that she was the intended victim and that the other Zodiac victims were killed just to cover up her death. However, over the years, many investigators have researched this possibility, and there has been no credible evidence that Darlene Farren knew her killer or that she had witnessed a murder.
But first, Gray Smith goes to talk to Melvin Belli, the celebrity lawyer. He learns Belli had been getting Christmas cards and several phone calls from the Zodiac. Gray Smith also finds out the housekeeper talked to the man on the phone, and he said on December 20th that it was just after his birthday. Meanwhile, at home, Melanie is mad that Gray Smith is getting involved because what if Zodiac wants to go after him? And he immediately gets a mysterious call, but it's not the Zodiac killer. It's a tipster who tells him that the Zodiac killer recorded his kills, and he should talk to Mr. Vaughn, who's friends with the Zodiac. The Zodiac's name is Rick Marshall. The anonymous tipster also says Marshall gave one of the snuff films to Vaughn for safekeeping, but Vaughn doesn't know what's on it. So Graysmith checks in with the police and learns that Marshall was a promising suspect, but was eventually dismissed. He also says Rick is a projectionist and draws the posters for the theaters that he works at. Graysmith gets a handwriting sample from the poster, and the expert says it's as close as they've ever seen. So here we have another lead that looks really promising.
Meanwhile, Toski and his new partner get a call that a new Zodiac letter came in. And when Toski gets there, Internal Affairs is also waiting for him. He's mentioned in the letter, and they think he forged it for attention. Toski is mad at Graysmith for dragging him back into this, and he's been taken off the case. So, of course, Graysmith's logical next steps are to work on the case with his children. I wonder why his marriage fell apart. In the midst of the research, one of his sons comes across the last cipher, and Graysmith immediately solves it and goes on TV. We never find out what it says, and Graysmith's solution has been disputed and eventually debunked. Cryptographer David Aranchek explains that particular cipher was actually never solved at all.
I have not yet seen plausible solutions. I've seen a lot of really creative solutions, and people have come up with a lot of creative and inventive ideas, but most of them end up bending the rules of the first message, thinking, possibly rightly, that Zodiac would have done the same. He would have come up with some other way to hide his message. But the trap that people fall in is they bend the rules so it's easier to make a message come out. Not makes it easier to find the actual message, but it makes it easier for other words and phrases to appear. And that gets people excited because when they start to see those words and messages appear, they think that they have an actual message. And I see this happening over and over again, people getting excited. It happens to me. When I would run my programs on the second cipher message and I'd come up with partial words and phrases, I would think, wow, that sounds a lot like something Zodiac would say. But it would only be a little part of the message that's decoded. The rest of it's all gibberish. So that's how I knew that I wasn't really on the right track, because you can find words that Zodiac would use, but they're just coming up randomly.
Back at home, Melanie is really upset that Graysmith's put himself in the spotlight, but Graysmith can't stop now and says, I need to stand there and look him in the eye and know it's him. He then immediately is distracted by a phone call that tells him to go meet Mr. Vaughn. Mr. Vaughn, again, is the man who is friends with suspect Rick Marshall and supposedly has a snuff film in his basement. He and Graysmith talk about how Marshall might be connected to the Zodiac. He admits Marshall did leave a film with him, but he had already picked it up. But it turns out the handwriting on the posters, which the expert says was the closest to the Zodiac, is Vaughn's himself.
Okay, so this is where the film gets, like, I feel like it's been a very, like, by the book sort of adaptation up until now. And then this is where Fincher's like, what if it's super spooky? Anyway, so so the two of them go down into a basement. And Graysmith thinks he hears someone upstairs. The floorboards are creaking. Vaughn says he's the only one at home. And Graysmith just like pieces right out. By the way, at no point does anyone like, no one continues to follow this lead. It's just like, I almost died and then I left. Is, I guess, how that went.
Yeah. I mean, we got to talk about this scene for a bit, because yeah. I'll just say that it was a holy crap moment when Vaughn says that, but sir, I write the handwriting, you know? It's like, I'm Pagliacci, you know? Like, it's like this whole, like, it's like this holy, I'm like, holy crap. And not only is it just conventionally scary on like a surface level of, hey, this guy might be the killer. But in addition, it also just kind of, but it throws more like uncertainty and doubt into the mix of like, is this, it makes the Zodiac identity out to be this almost metaphysical concept of something that's not knowable. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's like, oh, this guy is chasing this thing, and it's like, oh, actually, I wrote the posters, but like, I'm not even a suspect. You know, it's like, your brain is like breaking. First of all, it's terrifying, but then you're like, your brain is breaking. Like, wait a second. So like, you could be this. How would that even make sense? You know, and it's, the mind is just twirling, you know, while it's trying to figure this out. Meanwhile, Graysmith is like, yeah, I'll go down to your basement with you, even though you might be the killer. David Fincher apparently enjoys scenes where people think someone might be the killer and yet still enter their basement, which is not the only time he's used this plot mechanic, by the way.
When else does he use it?
in Girl with Dragon Tattoo.
Oh, okay.
He likes exploring that idea of why do people willingly subject themselves to danger? And it's because of the desire to know, I think.
And especially in California, where we don't have basements.
Right?
All right. I just love that I'm learning this from the movie Zodiac. All right. So Graysmith runs straight out of the basement, goes home, and his house is empty from one horror to the next. All the stuff is packed up, and there's a note on his taped on the phone, like, I took the kids to mom's, don't call me. So Melanie's left him. According to IMDb, the real Robert Graysmith only had one comment after reading the screenplay, which is, God, now I see why my wife divorced me, which is a great reaction. To me, I mean, this actually happened. Like, Graysmith's family fell apart. It's nice of Melanie to, like, take the kids that are maybe not her own. But, like, she's like, I'm not leaving them with that maniac, by the way. but, like, to me, it's not just the cost of the investigation. But I feel like once this happens, Graysmith is like, well, now I really have to solve this. Because if this was all for nothing, then, like, what am I even doing with my life? So this is where things...
Now he's, like, completely unhinged at this point, right? Like, he's unmoored. There's nothing holding him down at this point.
I think Gyllenhaal is good in this movie, but and I don't know how much they were constrained by the fact that, like, Graysmith wrote the book and, like, sort of was hanging around production or whatever. But, like, I feel like if Gyllenhaal were to play the same character now, he would play him even more unhinged. Like, this is something Gyllenhaal, I'm thinking, like, Gyllenhaal Nightcrawler. Like, Gyllenhaal in intense mode is something that he's only, like, expanded on and perfected since he made this movie.
Yes.
So this is comparatively a fairly sedate performance.
Yeah, yeah. You compare this to, Nightcrawler, Nocturnal Animals, another great unhinged Gyllenhaal performance, So, with no family in his way now, Graysmith is free to forge ahead, and he decides to talk to Linda, Darlene's sister, who's in prison. She agrees to meet him, and they talk about the person who may have been stalking Darlene. She says he had a short name, like a nickname. He keeps insisting, was it Rick? And then the most annoying insistence, he says, it was Rick. And she gets really angry, and he gets really angry, and then he gets up to leave, and suddenly she remembers it was Lee. Let's just talk about this scene for a moment. I think this scene really does a great job of getting at the extent to which Graysmith needs this thing that he's discovered to be the truth.
Yeah.
Right? Like, whatever idea he has, it has to be. It's got to be Rick. He doesn't even care about the truth anymore. He just needs to have an answer at this point.
He's like, I didn't get super frightened in a basement for it not to be Rick. So can you just go ahead and tell me that it's Rick? Thanks so much. This is a great scene. Yeah. The great Clea DuVall is playing this Darlene's sister. And I really love, like, she's got, like, bruises on her arm that's exposed, and Clea DuVall is just really good at these kinds of characters, which is just sort of like, people have tried to mess with you, but you are super tough and you have endured. And he's trying to bully her, and she's like, oh no, this is not gonna work on me, my friend. I'm not gonna give you whatever answer you conveniently want or need. So
because I could see, like, a lesser character might have just said, oh yeah, sure, whatever, Rick, you know, GTFO, I don't care.
Exactly.
But she was not going to be bullied into saying something that was wrong. Great performance there, and kind of chilling. You know, you kind of get a sense, like, this person's had a really, really difficult life in the 2 minutes that she's on screen.
Yeah.
So there were indeed suspicions of a man who had been reported as stalking Darlene Farren. It was not Arthur Lee Allen. It was actually a man named Larry Kane, who is also known as Suspect B. Kane was also connected to a murder in Lake Tahoe that might have been the Zodiac. The inspector who took over the case, Tom Brutton, explains.
He also was identified by the Farren sisters as being an acquaintance of the victim in that case. And he was in the Navy. He may have learned cryptology there. He was identified by Kathleen Johns as being the person who abducted her and her young child. So there was about 20 other items that kind of pointed to Suspect B as being the Zodiac.
But with Kane, as with the rest of the suspects, there just wasn't enough evidence to say for sure.
But the film version of Graysmith is stuck on Alan. He seems like literally runs to the Vallejo police station, and he's just there standing in the rain, and the officers are kind of like looking at him through the glass door. They take a while to let him inside, and the Vallejo officer doesn't agree with Graysmith's assessment, saying the name is one in a million. We skipped over an earlier scene where Graysmith goes to Vallejo, which I really like, where he has to like go into the files and memorize everything. He's not allowed to have his pens, etc. And there's just this great moment that I just want to highlight when he walks out and there's another Vallejo police officer played by James LeGros, who we'll see again before the end of the film. And he's like, who's that guy? And the cop played by Elias Koteas is like, oh, Robert Graysmith, he's going to solve the Zodiac case or whatever. And James LeGros' character just goes, oh, good for him. In like a line reading that just thrills and delights me. So I just wanted to make sure.
It's a great performance.
We put that in there. Okay, so back at home, no family, no conclusive evidence. Graysmith's obsession has room to grow. There are newspaper articles, files, and notes everywhere. Someone comes in. Is it the murderer? No. It's Chloe Sevigny. His wife, his ex, soon to be ex. She's annoyed with him, but she tries to talk to him. We learn that he left his job to pursue this book full time. She calls their marriage The Date That Didn't End, which actually could be like a fun romantic way to describe a marriage if it were a different marriage than this. And she tells him to finish the book. And as she leaves, Graysmith sees Lee's license in the evidence folders. And he realizes that Lee's birthday is right before December 20th. And as we've already talked about, his logic is flawed, but it's his movie, so let's let him have it.
So Graysmith dramatically runs to Toski's house and yells through the window, it's Lee! Toski and Graysmith go to an all-night diner and have a long talk about why the evidence didn't work. He finally gets Toski to agree with him that Alan is their best suspect, but without the hard evidence, they can't do anything. Let's talk about this diner scene for a moment. I think it's awesome. My favorite moment from this diner scene is when he's using the salt and pepper shakers to say, like, you know, this person lived next to this person, you know, and they're like, they're no more than 50 yards apart. And he says, you know, do you know that for sure? And he says, I've walked it. And he almost says it under his breath, like he's ashamed of it, but he knows it for a fact. And that's an amazing moment because, first of all, you now are struck by how obsessed he is with it, right? And just like, oh, this guy knows this thing through and through. But also, the implication of that is there's a ton of research this guy's been doing that you just never see on screen. And I know we see this earlier with the articles and the books in his house and everything like that, but like, he's gone to these people's house. He's walked it. Like, there's all the stuff that he's doing you don't even know about. The stuff he's doing that you know about is already really extreme, but there's stuff you don't even have access to in this movie. So it's a great moment. And then, of course, also there's the fact that throughout the movie, Toski is mooching off food from everyone else. He's asking for animal crackers. He's eating Anthony Edwards' character's sandwich, and so on. And in this scene, Toski pays for both their meals, which is, I think, a sign that he has gotten a lot out of this conversation.
This is also like a costume, a Toski costume. Like, we've seen him wear the bow ties, which Toski actually did. We've seen him all this stuff, but he's wearing a navy blue button down where the collar is sort of very high up, but he's got his holster on. And Steve McQueen in Bullet, like iconically on the poster, is wearing a turtleneck that looks very similar to this with the holster. It's like his most Bullet look is in this diner scene, which feels like a really intentional visual connection that they make here. So knowing, or at least believing at last, that it's Lee, Graysmith goes to fulfill his promise and look the Zodiac killer in the eyes. Graysmith finds him in a hardware store, and they have that, you know, passing eye contact moment. Apparently, Graysmith really did track down Lee at his place of employment, but we don't know for certain whether or not Lee was actually the Zodiac killer. 7 years later, we see that Vallejo cop from earlier, played by James LeGros. He has an older version of Michael Mongeau, who's the male victim from the first murder that we see in the film, the second murder that the Zodiac killer committed. He is played by Westworld star Jimmy Simpson, and he is here to look at a few photographs. In this film version of the scene, Michael Mongeau points at Lee as the guy who attacked him. This, of course, didn't really happen. We talked earlier about how Mongeau said he wouldn't be a good eyewitness, but it makes a nice little bookend for the film that we're watching.
Yeah, and I was impressed by the scene because it made a big impact on me watching it the first time around and then rewatching it for this podcast. This is Jimmy Simpson in his, you know, way before he has a chance to go to Westworld, and he's doing pretty badly. Like, he's unshaven, he's unkempt, he doesn't look like he's in a good state, and I feel like just with his physical appearance, he's conveying kind of the damage that this character has done to his life, right, with this murder attempt. It really made an impression on me because it's so striking how kind of shabby he looks in this scene. And again, talking about that blast radius, right? Like this character or this actual killer just leaves this trail of destruction in his wake. It was upsetting to see.
Yeah.
It was
upsetting to see. We didn't mention at the top, but the younger version of Mongeau is played by Lee Norris, who I know best as a child of the 90s. I know best as Stuart Minkus from the TV show Boy Meets World. And he's just like a very clean cut, nice looking guy. He became sort of somewhat famous for playing like a nerd on that show. So he's just like a really just like clean cut boy. And then, to see him as Jimmy Simpson. And this is something that Jimmy Simpson does do well in many shows outside of Westworld, which is just look like someone at the absolute end of their rope. There's something about the way that you can especially dishevel Jimmy Simpson's hair that it like gets you there. And you know, he's a great actor. He looks just very haunted and hollowed out by the whole experience. So it's one of my favorite, as you say, blast radius moments of the film.
Interesting fact, John Robinson. I've never heard someone use the word dishevel as a verb until today. So nicely done.
Thank you.
Of course, it wouldn't be a real Truth versus Hollywood movie or podcast episode if we didn't get a Where Are They Now montage. There's a bunch of text on the screen that appears after we see this Michael Mongeau scene. So let's talk about what actually happened. So authorities talked about arresting Alan, but Alan died of a heart attack before they could. In 2002, they got a partial fingerprint off of one of the letters that ruled him out. In 2004, San Francisco deactivated their case.
Something that I love that we saw, though, is that the case is still open in Vallejo and I think Solano, where they have Alan still listed as their number one suspect, which I think is fascinating, as of when Zodiac was released. Toski was cleared of all charges of forging the letter and retired in 1989. Paul Avery died of emphysema in 2000, and Gray Smith published his book that then became a movie, and he is still alive as of this recording. But of course, that's not the end of this story. It's 2020. We still have no idea who the Zodiac Killer is, and there are a ton of amateur sleuths who are still trying to solve it. San Francisco Chronicle reporter Duffy Jennings says the tips still keep coming in.
I left the newspaper in 1980, and I still get a half a dozen emails or phone calls or inquiries a year from people saying, I know who it is, and it's this guy or it's that guy. And as you know, we've had instances of people who claim it was their father or somebody they knew.
So where might the Zodiac Killer be today? Here's Zodiac case expert Michael Butterfield on a couple of possibilities.
There are theories that the reason the Zodiac crime stopped is because the Zodiac is either dead or in prison. I personally don't subscribe to those theories. I believe that if he was incarcerated, it's possible that we would have information that would identify him, such as his fingerprints and other evidence.
There are still four of the Zodiac Killer ciphers that have not been solved. In 2015, a new documentary series, Hunt for the Zodiac Killer, where they built a computer algorithm that supposedly solved one of the ciphers, well, most people are not super impressed with it. And there have been a few dozen possible solutions over the years, but all of them, this is according to experts, seem forced in one way or another, in the sense that they feel like they're trying to squeeze in evidence into possible explanations. So overall, now that we're at the end of this, you know, and the Zodiac Killer, it's a case that essentially remains unsolved, although the evidence heavily points to Arthur Lee Allen, but there's a bunch of evidence that points away from Arthur Lee Allen as well. You know, what do you make of the movie overall, John Robinson? And I guess, you know, as it relates to the Zodiac Killer case in real life, what do you feel like is the function of this movie, given that it's talking about a true story?
I think the thing that the movie does the most effectively is talk about the toll, an unsolved horror, and the toll it can take on the people who consider themselves heroes, protectors, defenders. You know what I mean? Like, we talk about a lot of the men in this like working this case as fathers. You know, they're out here like trying to protect this community, and the frustration they feel at not being able to find an answer that will put people's mind at rest is part of what takes such a heavy toll on them. It's complicated to me. I have a couple thoughts about what works and what doesn't work about this film. I keep mentioning the fact that if this film were made now, if this story were made now, it would be a limited series TV show. And I kind of feel like Zodiac exists in this weird middle ground where I think it's too long for a feature film and too short as it stands right now for like a TV series. And so I would almost love to see this story again. Same cast. I wouldn't change anything about the cast, but I would like to see it expanded into like, let's say, 6 episodes, and then maybe just get more of the people, like maybe let the wives actually talk or something like that, you know, like some more of the home life or some more of the victims' right. lives or like whatever it is, like deep in the roots of this case. As I think there was just too much story for Fincher to tell, even in the 2.5 hour runtime of this film. And then I also have a question about the responsibility you have when you're telling a story that involves real people, especially real people who were murdered. And it, to me, it feels a little irresponsible to try to insinuate that there is an answer to something that, you know, the authorities who have tried to solve this don't actually have an answer to. And so there's a part of me that almost wishes this were, you know, a based on a true story film where they changed even like changed the names of people, changed other things so that they weren't
where it's not the Zodiac. It's not called Zodiac. It's called something else. You mean?
Yeah. I understand why you would call it Zodiac. I just think that like, purporting to have solved a case that people haven't solved, and not that anyone's like saying they solved it, but like, you know,
well, I think when you watch this movie, it's heavily implied that
exactly,
you know, Lee is the killer. Even the final text of the movie, right? It says like, oh, like Graysmith claims he's never received one of those anonymous calls since Lee died. And I don't know, like technically the movie doesn't solve who the Zodiac Killer is, right? It never outright says, by the way, incontrovertibly, Lee was the Zodiac Killer. It never says that. But like, you're watching the movie, and I think most people are going to think, well, Lee was the killer. That is my impression watching the movie. And I agree with you. You shouldn't present it that way if that's not actually the case, which, because of how complicated this case is, we can never really know.
Right, right? Exactly. I mean, like, my deep suspicion is that, according to authorities, really only 4 murders can actually be attributed to the Zodiac Killer, or 5, because the first one had 2 victims. But, like, it feels like to me, it's impossible to know, like, what this person knew when they knew it, who wrote what letter when, and all that sort of stuff. There's just too many question marks without conclusive physical evidence that just makes me feel like this, like, I don't know, the Jack the Ripper case or something, is something where we're going to just be chasing our tails for the rest of our lives around this one, you know?
Yeah, yes. I think when you watch the movie, you get the impression, like, Lee is the killer. But at times, it seems to also be saying, like, even something where you have millions of people who know about this case, you have millions of people trying to solve these ciphers, you have multiple murders where, like, the just did it. Sometimes he did it in a public area, right? there's something essentially unknowable about who the killer is. It seems to me like what is another message the movie is trying to get across. And there is a real toll from people trying to chase something that is essentially unknowable, right? That it takes a huge personal toll on many of these people's lives. And obsession has this huge cost. And at the end of the day, there is no reward for it. You know, there is no grand moment where all of your work is revealed to be worth it and so on. And I think that is brought to light most strikingly in the scene where Gray Smith meets Robert Lee Allen, right? And he's at the hardware store and he's like, he's hoping it's going to be a specific kind of interaction or kind of reaction. And he clearly doesn't get it. You know, that's ultimately what I'm left with is like, this movie feels like it's about the cost of obsession and how easy obsession can come to any of us.
Absolutely. And like, I mean, the guy wrote a book. The book was made into a movie, a well-regarded movie. At least his story or his theory of the case is out there and a lot of people saw it. So that's like a victory, I suppose. But it still doesn't mean the case is solved or closed. Maybe he got closure in his own mind, but I don't know.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of Truth vs. Hollywood. The next film we'll be discussing is the Best Picture winner from 2012, Argo. One thing the film changed, Victor Garber should have been the star of the whole movie. So say we all.
Yeah, and not just because he's a great actor, but we'll discuss that next time. Truth vs. Hollywood is an Audio Boom and World Media Rights co-production hosted by me, David Chen.
And me, Joanna Robinson.
It's produced by Audio Boom's Rachel Jacobs, Casey Georgie, Blair Payton, and Lauren Vogel, and by Pascal Hughes for World Media Rights, with help from James Tyndale. You can find more of my work at culturallyrelevantshow.com. I host a show called Culturally Relevant, where I interview filmmakers and artists, and also the Slash Filmcast at slashfilmcast.com, where I talk about movies on a weekly basis.
You can find me talking about films, award season films, it's Emmy season time, all that kind of stuff on Vanity Fair's Little Gold Men podcast, or also I will be watching some fun TV shows over on Vanity Fair's Still Watching podcast.
Until next time, stay truthful, people.